Beaming out across the galaxy, this is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello, and welcome to the Free Zone. Well, as you all know, our world has been flipped on its head and squished inside out, and it is so hard to make heads or tails of what's going on with our facts or our alternative facts. We can't seem to get a straight picture and understanding where the machinations of this cabal that run our planet are really going, and how much is distraction, how much do we really need to focus on. We've got Seth Rich, we've got Russia, we've got North Korea and nukes, Trump versus this, that, and the other, and what we need to be able to discern what is distraction and what is actual game plan that is going on. And tonight we are so lucky because we have James Corbett coming to us live from Japan. Now, the Corbett Report has been going on for nearly a decade. Actually, his 10-year anniversary is coming right up. And this is an individual journalist that has managed to uncover so many of the secret diabolical schemes that are going on behind us that I wanted to bring James to you to really give him props for all of the effort that he has done in his proper predictions. I want to understand some more of his methodology and then the ability to cause widespread resistance. And this is really what we're all about, is understanding where to focus and then how we can do something about it. So folks, please welcome from the Corbett Report, James Corbett.
Thank you so much for having me on, Freeman. I've been doing this for almost 10 years, as you point out, but it's been, I don't know, it's been at least 4 or 5 since we last talked, so it's good to talk to you again.
That is true. That is very true. Yeah, it is. And since the last time we talked, boy, the world has turned on its head. Did you ever see Donald Trump becoming president, man? I mean, oh my God.
No one did.
No, you couldn't have seen this. I mean, I wonder about that one so much because, you know, I don't really believe in the rogue president. And I think that the cabal that's in charge really win either way. Either we got New World Hillary in there or we get lunatic Trump. You know, it's a lose-lose situation. But there is a game plan and a scheme. And, you know, we're looking at what seems to be like an alphabet soup with the SPP and the SOPA and the TPP and the WTO. And no one really is able to keep up with all this. But you have managed to pull together, while you weren't looking, globalists just passed a major trade deal. Now, I've stood before riot squads trying to stamp down the WTO, and, you know, it's, you're like an ant against a giant. But you have managed to outline and bring forward the methodologies so that people can see why they should pay attention to this alphabet soup.
Well, I like to think so, and thank you for singing my praises. But in fact, you're talking about an article that I wrote recently about this new major trade deal that got passed. And in that article, I point out the fact that, well, everyone that I know, including me, missed this big new trade deal that was coming down the line because of the 24/7 news cycle that's keeping us flooded and unable to focus on some of the big picture issues. And I lost track of this one altogether. So I'm glad that a listener of mine brought it to my attention. And I think that just goes to show that no one of us is able to keep track of all of this.
That's it's right. Only we when are we combine our efforts. Yeah. 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 We are all a team here, folks.
You know. Exactly right. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. Good. I mean, I'm certainly no superhuman or anything of the sort. For people who don't know, this is a brand new globalist trade deal that just passed. And in fact, it is the first trade deal that has been accomplished under the World Trade Organization. The WTO is 2 decades old now, and yet they have failed to pass a single actual agreement on world trade until now.
Wow. So I didn't need to be battling them back there in 96. I could have waited a couple of decades.
Well, yeah.
Sorry,
well, it's interesting, actually, because clearly there was widespread resistance to the WTO and its agenda when it was first coming into being. And we did see those massive protests, and everyone remembers the battle in Seattle and all of that sort of
stuff. Exactly.
But I think this is a sign of the flexibility of the ruling psychopaths that makes them agile and more capable of basically constructing their prison, or at least their attempt at constructing it, because it's obvious that people will come out in droves to protest these types of meetings and events and deals when they're made out in the open and out in public and in a way that is protestable. So I think the obvious answer for if you are a ruling psychopath who wants to make sure that your plans go ahead is to not do it in that manner. And so we've seen over the last couple of decades that although I'm sure they wanted to have the WTO as the big framework organization that they can just rubber stamp whatever kind of trade legislation they want, they've just gone with plan B, which is to do a lot of these bilateral and multilateral trade deals under different umbrellas, kind of a shifting focus or a shifting circus of people that are involved in these that doesn't give a still target for people to aim at. There's always something new and some crazy acronym deal that no one's heard about yet and is being negotiated behind closed doors in murky deals. And that's a lot harder to protest than if there is this face of globalization like the WTO. So I think that's been one of their tricks. But here we are now a couple decades later, and they actually have just passed their first agreement, which seems, at first glance, it doesn't seem like a huge deal. It's a trade facilitation agreement. So this is about harmonizing procedures on customs and basically trying to get rid of some of the red tape of international trade. And it sounds, of course, all wonderful and happy and in the WTO's PR language. So it's about technical assistance and capacity building in the area of effective cooperation between customs and blah, blah, blah. But I think a couple of things. First of all, the fact that they've accomplished this deal at all is significant because, again, it is the first thing the WTO has really accomplished so far. They've been arguing their Doha development round of talks now for a decade and a half, and they're still no further along with that. So, and that's a good thing, obviously. But I mean, this, if anything, gives a little bit of booster fuel for their rocket to try to facilitate that global trade deal they're working on. But secondarily, I think some of the things that are embedded in this trade facilitation agreement they've passed are worrying. When it comes to things about e-payments, e-purchasing, trying to harmonize and standardize the electronic payment system for these types of settlements of international trade, because this is just one more brick in that wall of the coming cashless society, cashless control grid. And this is just one way in which it's going to be slotted into place behind the scenes, quietly. Like, I think the real global government luster afters, the globalists really do want, is to do this type of thing through bodies like the WTO, through trade facilitation agreements that no one reads or hears about, as a way of getting these kinds of things through and getting them slotted into place through the infrastructure of global trade itself, so that most people will not interact with it on a day-to-day basis, but it'll be there, like the special drawing rights of the IMF, which, again, is not a currency per se. No one ever uses it. You can't buy a stick of bubble gum with it, but it will eventually, if the globalists have their way, be the sort of framework for a global, not a global currency per se, but at least the global consolidation of monetary power, which is the same thing for in the eyes of the globalists. So it's a sneaky process, and that's why it's a constant battle to try to stay informed of what is going on so we can more accurately and actively resist it.
So the World Trade Facilitation Agreement. Yeah, you say no one reads, and that includes even the House and the Senate.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you, I mean, you think legislators are going to read this? Of course not. Yeah, no, and then that's exactly the point of things like the WTO, is to circumvent the national legislators of all of the signatory countries. And in fact, this shows how the WTO works, because I don't think most people understand. It was ratified by 2/3 of the WTO membership, this facilitation agreement. I can't remember exactly how many members the WTO has, 164 members. So there were 164 countries signed up at the WTO. 2/3 of them ratified this agreement. Therefore, it goes into place. And that means every country that is a signatory to the WTO is now under the purview of this agreement, whether they ratified it or not. That's how the WTO works. That's how the global government is going to work or is already working, I suppose.
Right. And they need to condition all of us. You know, I saw this show called The Wall. I don't know if you've seen this in Japan, but, you know, here they are putting on a show called The Wall, right, as, you know, we're building a wall. And I'm tying this all together with Trump and his removal of legislation, removal of regulations, and pretty much, you know, right in the hand of this whole situation. But what struck me about this television show, game show, right, The Wall, was that you had to be a good citizen in order to win the $1 million or millions of dollars for having this tinker ball come down the thing. I mean, it's like, you know, Chinese pinball, right?
Okay.
But in order to get on the game show itself, you first have to be a proper citizen. You know, you have to be a fireman that saves somebody. You've got to be the pilot from a 9/11 event. You know, you got to be the proper citizen to be included into the game and to be able to make it in this system. So I see a lot of social engineering coming into the situation to prepare us to be the proper citizens under this global network. I wondered if you had any ideas on that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I haven't seen this show that you're talking about, so
I'm not surprised.
About
it's not very good, no. But the whole point being
exactly what you're talking about there brings to mind for me what is one of the true dangers going forward in the 21st century, not the Orwellian boot on the face, jackbooted fascist tyranny that people are expecting Big Brother 1984 to look like, so much as the flip side of that, which is the incentivization for people to actually put the chains on themselves. It's a game, guys. The more points you make in this game, the better your life will be. And so that's the idea. You know, the better citizen you are, the more rewards you'll have. And of course, being a good citizen means listening to your government and doing as you're told and not asking questions and blah, blah, blah. And we're starting to see how that is being engineered into society, literally engineered by social engineers in, for example, China, where they are at least toying with this idea of social credit. And this is going to, at least this is the long-term plan, this is going to be tied into rewards that you get as a Chinese citizen. So if you want to get a travel visa to travel to another country, well, you better have a good enough social credit score from the government. And how do you get a good social credit score? Well, they're starting to gamify that and incentivize it. They're starting to create systems like Sesame Credit and others where they will give you points for example, you know, reposting some Chinese Communist Party government propaganda piece. If you repost that on your social media, well, hey, you get a social credit score. You know, good for you, plus one. It's the gamification of society itself. And this has been coming for years now. I mean, we could go back to Skinner and B.F. Skinner and all of those, you know, behaviorists who were discovering the kind of, you know, the behavioral psychology to how to engineer society. And it's the same thing with getting the pigeon to turn around in a counterclockwise circle 3 times or whatever you want to get it to do. You just step by step encourage it with little pellets for rewards, or you shock, give it a shock if you don't want it to do something. And eventually you can get even the lowliest pigeon to do all of these things that are quite complicated movements. Well, it's not all that different for the human animal either. They just got to give you the right rewards in the right way and shock you when you do the wrong thing. And pretty soon people will be doing it. And that process has become so refined by gamification, turning everything into a game and giving people points and giving people the feeling that they're leveling up. And it's turning society into a game. So there was a really disturbing presentation I saw about this years ago that I've pointed out a couple of times. It's on YouTube under the title Most Disturbing Presentation Ever, Our Tech Nightmare. So look that up. But it's a guy talking about what the world might look like in a few years once this has been applied to everything. Where you get, you know, you get 5 points if you brush your teeth for, you know, 2 minutes. And the toothbrush will, of course, be embedded with sensors. So it will be able to detect how long you've been brushing your teeth. And, you know, just every single aspect of everything we do in our daily lives. And, you know, some of it might be for our own good. Maybe it's, you know, you should be brushing your teeth. But it's always the question of, well, who is engineering this game? And what kind of, you know, point system is being put into place for us to become quote unquote good citizens? And how can this be used against us? And I think we have to at least be aware of this process and how people are incentivized to do what they do. Because if we just stumble into it blindly, I think that's when we're in the real danger.
Absolutely. And that's why something like the Corbett Report is so important. I love independent news, man, you know, and someone that has a grasp of what's going on in the bigger picture so that you can focus down on this. I mean, this whole Russia-Trump situation, I mean, does that feel like a weird lark to you, or does this feel like something that people should be really engaged in?
Oh, well, I certainly wouldn't ask people to get engaged in anything in the political realm in the sense of investing your identity in it or getting wrapped up in it. Clearly, I mean, anything that the corporate foundation funded controlled media is telling you to focus on will not be good for your ultimate good, psychological or otherwise. And I think this is an example of that. Now, I mean, the Trump phenomenon and what's going on with all of this is fascinating in so many different ways, but perhaps that's kind of the point. To fascinate people and to get them drawn into the narrative. And there are interesting things that we can take away from this. One of the most interesting takes I've read on this recently was from Jeffrey Tucker, writing at fee.org. And he wrote this really interesting article about how the reason that the sort of center left of the political spectrum, if you situate yourself on that spectrum, which I do not, by the way, but if you do and you're on the center left, the reason why people are so apoplectic and absolutely deranged by the Trump presidency is because it is delegitimizing the government. It's taking that holy sheen and the sort of the what do you call it? The angels have the thing around their head.
Oh, the halo or the
halo. Yes. Yeah. It's taking the Corona halo away from the president and taking the sheen off of this holy sector of the public sector. Oh, it's only the most virtuous go into this. And yeah, there may be some bad people who get into office sometimes, but the idea of the office of the president is this thing that must be approached with awe and reverence and respect. And whatever else you say, I mean, clearly, I don't think that's going to be the same at the end of the Trump era. So that's why people are reacting to it so strongly. It's not even so much about the day-to-day, this piece of news or that piece of news. It's about the delegitimization of government itself. So I think that to me is the most interesting part of this, because I've gone through a political journey of my own over the last decade, as people who've been listening to my podcast know, and I've arrived on the other side of anarchism/voluntarism. Right. I have zero interest in the political game and in electing rulers to rule over us. Oh, this slave master will be slightly better than that slave master. Yay. It is a game that they get you to play like so many others. And I think it's part of social engineering as well. The only problem is it's so effective.
Isn't
that
it?
I've even seen people who used to identify as anarchists now being, well, you wouldn't want Hillary to get in, right? As long as they can give you, you know, one sandwich that's filled with more feces than the other, then, well, you've got to choose the sandwich that has less feces.
Yeah, and another thing that you're mentioning is our global perception, and this is something that I've started calling the honey boo-boo effect, where everybody is getting American ideals through our media, which is honey boo-boo, and, you know, they're looking back on America like we're a big joke, and it's definitely being put out there. Now, you know, we got a president that's been on WWF, you know, it's like, So, you know, we got people need to realize that we are no longer in a national situation. It is now global in every way, shape, and form that we have to think. We see the WTO formed, we see the UN formed, NATO taken over, and all the situations, and we are still thinking national, as if the leaders of our nation are thinking national and wanting to, you know, make America great again. But really, the picture is global.
Absolutely. And that is one of the biggest tricks that's been pulled on people, is that people still largely think of these political figures, as if the political figureheads and puppets themselves are actually running the show, when of course it's the puppeteers who are running the show. But secondarily, people think of, well, this person is from the United States, therefore he is interested in the United States interests. Well, are you really sure about that? And there are so many different ways that we can interrogate that notion. But unfortunately, I think there's another trap embedded in that narrative, and it's a larger point, and it's subtle, but it leads us, if we become aware of this game, and we become aware that the real people at the top of this power pyramid do not identify with nation states and do not care about the United States per se. They just want to protect themselves and their families' wealth and their power and positions in the global structure. It leads us into the trap of believing then that the effective opposition to globalism is nationalism. And I think that's the false trap that's been implanted, because nationalism and globalism are two sides of the same coin of collectivism. It is, you have to give your identity up to this nebulously defined collective. And because it's very similar to the Trump-Hillary thing. Well, Trump would have been better than Hillary. Hillary would have started World War III already. Well, okay. So does that mean then that everything bad that happens under Trump is forgivable because Hillary maybe theoretically would have been worse?
Right.
In the same way, globalism, yeah, clearly if there's a global government of a very few people, you know, oligarchs, psychopaths ruling everyone, that would be a very bad thing. But that doesn't mean that national government of ruling oligarchs and psychopaths is necessarily that much better or something that we should be aiming at. And it's a difficult point to get people to understand, but the way I would make it into a metaphor, an analogy, if they can get you they want to get you rallying around the UN flag or something like that, right? But of course, people would see through that very easily. But as long as they can get you to rally around a flag, they can still control that system. As long as you give yourself over to some collective, oh, you know, it's the nation state. Oh, I have to do this for king and country, or whatever the 21st century equivalent of that would be, then they're winning. This has to be about reclaiming our understanding of individual sovereignty and how we as individuals can work together in communities of interest to create the world that we want. And in a sense, that might be global in nature, not globalist in the sense of what the psychopaths want to bring in, but arbitrary lines on a map mean nothing to free human beings. We have to combat this idea of collectivism, which is at the core of both nationalism and globalism, to really understand and really fight back, not fight back against the system, create the alternative structure that we want to bring into existence.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. Resistance without anger, anarchy without chaos. That's one of the hardest things to get people to believe in, to try and tell them. And this is one of the reasons I often brought up the ideas of synchronicity and, you know, these divine coincidences, because I want to change people's outlook on reality so that they have the ability to walk in the direction they want to go. We've talked about all the conditioning that we've been suffering and all the ideas. I mean, we are absolutely in a slave state. We are absolutely in a mental state of slavery. And the idea for people, when you start talking about resistance, first it's anger. And then when you talk about anarchy, they expect chaos. And I've seen that there is, I mean, in every home of every animal on this planet, there is a system that works for, you know, the hummingbird makes a hummingbird nest, you know, beaver builds a dam. They, you know, every animal knows its place, and the humans are no different. We're just way more magnificent in so many ways that we can actually think it ahead first and put this together. So the concepts of trying to break free, resistance without anger and anarchy without chaos. Do you have thoughts on that?
I do. And I believe, I don't remember, but I believe the first place that I heard this phrase was from you. So if so, hats off to you. At any rate, I'll give you credit. I think the key phrase is not overthrow the government. It is overgrow the government.
Yes, sir.
Right? It isn't about as if we're all going to march on Washington with pitchforks and throw the bums out and, you know, everything will be better. Because, I mean, even if that were to be accomplished, which it is not in this age of the 21st century police state and all the gadgets that the government has to throw at people, where they have been planning and plotting and waiting and growing their army, their internal army of to quell domestic insurrection for decades now, at the very least. So they're ready for that. They're sitting there saying, bring it on, guys. Come on, do exactly. It. You know, you want to get angry. You want to come with your pitchforks. Come on, we're ready. That is not going to accomplish what people want to accomplish. And what do people want to accomplish? As I say, if they're caught in the nationalist mindset, if they're caught in the political mindset, then they're just going to want to throw the bums out and then put new bums into power. Right. I mean, what is that going to accomplish at the end of the day? Nothing. So this the idea of resistance to this globalist system is utterly meaningless unless we have an actual alternative to bring into being. And that's where I think the ideas of peaceful resistance, but also conscious resistance, as well as anarchism, do come into play. And everyone has their own ways of understanding how this can be and what, you know, what, how could the world work without government and all of this. And I know it is a monumental thing to get around people's defenses that have been erected around this subject by decades of indoctrination from everyone, from their parents to their school teachers to everyone else, probably taught them about, you know, the fundamental, we need government. So one way that I would like people to at least try to start thinking about this in a different way would be to, I recently did a video where I talked about, what do you want to be when you grow up? Of course, that was the question that we heard a bajillion times when we were growing up. And I think most interesting people I know never actually have an answer to that. I'll tell you in a few years. I'll tell you in a few decades. I'll tell you at the end of my life. But we, of course, all heard this question many times when growing up. And I imagine most people, but I certainly had to do that school assignment at, I don't know, would have been junior high. What do you Americans say? Middle school? Whatever. Where you have to imagine, you know, pick a career that you think you might want to pursue and then research that career and, you know, make a game plan. How are you going to go about becoming blah, blah, blah? So at the time, I thought, well, I like writing. I want to be a writer, so I'll be a writer. And so as part of this project, you had to interview someone in the industry to find out about it and whatever. So I ended up interviewing my mom's friend who had, I think, self-published a little book of poetry that, you know, three people had read or something. And at the time, I was sitting there doing this project and I was thinking, you know, this isn't very useful for me. And I don't think this is going to actually play into how my life will unfold, but it's my school assignment, so I gotta do it. And it turns out I was completely right that it was a useless project, because what is my job now? I am now sitting here in my living room in Japan podcasting for a living. That is so mind-blowing to me that I have to pinch myself almost every day that is this a career? I'm doing it professionally. I guess it's a career, but
right.
This, what I am doing, would have been literally unimaginable a couple of decades ago. The technology for doing this didn't even exist at that time, let alone the idea of doing it. So how could I possibly have planned this out? Now, the point here isn't, I mean, the real point of this is to say no one can or should be managing an economy. I mean, the idea is so ridiculous. It presumes not only that there are some angels descended from heaven with special powers to find the good for every single person and try to provide for them, which of course is the lie that the psychopaths in power want you to believe, but secondarily, that even if they could decide, they could analyze you and go, Freeman, this is what is best for you, and this is what will give you the most happiness in your life. They still couldn't provide it to you because no one can predict or know what is coming in technologically and otherwise in the future. It is in constant flux. And that is a good thing. It is a good thing that we do not have the ability as human beings to completely map out our lives and know every single step of everything that's going to happen. And no one should presume, anytime someone comes into your life and tells you, I'm going to be stewarding over your life, and I'm going to be providing for you, and I'm going to be doing this and that, you should be suspicious of them, because they are not in a position, epistemologically or otherwise, to be able to do that for you. And that, to me, is kind of what government is. It's, you know, oh, which slave master should we elect to steward over the economy to decide what's going to be best for, you know, however 300 million people or whatever it is in your country of choice, of residence? It's a ridiculous and false idea. And I think on its face, when you really examine it, it's ridiculous. But we've been so indoctrinated to believe in such things that we just accept it as a matter of course. Oh, yes, this person will steward over the economy and be able to direct it and control it and do things for it. So when we start to think not of the economy, as in as if it's some sort of thing that can be engineered and tinkered with, and oh, we'll adjust the rate here and we'll increase the money supply there. When we start to think instead of the actual spontaneous human interactions that really is what we mean when we talk about the economy, then we start to get a better understanding of how it is that such a thing can function without a central controlling oligarch that's going to, tell you what to do with your life. And that's one window into the broader point of the fact that we don't need the ruling oligarchs to rule over us. And it shouldn't be the point where we have to really elaborate and convince people that they don't need these psychopaths perched over them to tell them what to do. But it's, a testament to how thoroughly they have indoctrinated the public generally, that it really is an uphill battle to get people to even begin to question that, let alone to actually see it.
Absolutely. And people have no idea. I mean, they so live in the 20th, even 19th century. I was at the post office today and stopped dropping off some Aliens from Hell DVDs because they banned that worldwide. Now, there's another action in there where they can just so limit us through this situation and cut us off from the world. And, you know, who calls up YouTube? I don't know how to call up YouTube or Google and be like, hey, why did you do that? Aliens from Hell is perfectly legit. Why are you removing this from the internet? But I was at the post office giving those DVDs out to my fans. And, I started talking. Well, actually, I had one unpackaged and the postman was like, Aliens from Hell. He's like, what is that, Nubaru? And I was shocked. I was like, holy shit, you know Nubaru? That's awesome. He's like, yeah, try me. I know everything. And so I threw a bunch of things at him. He knew about the monolith on Phobos. He knew all kinds of crazy stuff. And I was like, well, all right, I'm impressed. But what do you think about glow-in-the-dark cats or glow-in-the-dark pigs? And he was like, that's never going to happen. You know, and I'm like, you're way behind, dude.
That you might want to look it up.
That was like, you know, almost a decade ago that we had glow-in-the-dark pigs, man. But so as you're saying this, we're looking at a situation where something like the AI technology of Watson can actually supplant every lawyer in the world. And all of a sudden that occupation's gone. And we don't know at this moment where anything is going to go. So yes, the idea of trying to manage a system that is growing organically through this new technology and becoming, you know, and then there's, if you want to get into this, the other side of the puzzle where people say, well, let's get rid of governments and just hand everything over to AI.
Yes, the technocracy, which is, exactly right. Because that is, and people like to talk about that idea as if it's a startlingly new idea and, oh, it'll be so great. It's never been tried before, guys, right? Actually, yes, it has been. The explicit goal of, well, I mean, the Soviets, I mean, that was a Soviet dream of the complete centralization of society and the top-down command control. And it was going to be engineered technologically. They were constructing systems in place to try to technologically keep track of and determine exactly what everybody needed. And the absolute ridiculous level of this and what it ultimately ended up being was revealed so brilliantly in a documentary by Adam Curtis. And I'm going to forget which documentary it was, but it should be easy enough to look up. But in this documentary, they did an interview with some of these old Soviet technocrats whose job it was to try to determine exactly how many toothbrushes, how many pairs of bras, how many things had to be produced every month in order to, you know, feed and clothe and take care of the entire population of the Soviet Union. And they showed the data that they had to go through. And it was, of course, back in the old day, it was just these huge reams of this printer paper that just reams and reams and reams and reams of data that they had from coming in from all over the Soviet Union about how many pairs of toothbrushes were consumed last month and how many they'll need for next month. And the absurdity of the idea was revealed in that. Again, the idea that this can be centrally determined because, of course, the next question is, okay, well, we need, you know, 800,000 toothbrushes or whatever it is. What color should they be? What style should they be? Should they be hard toothbrushes or soft bristle? Or should we have maybe a sort of intermediate? Or maybe we should have all three. But then how many of each of those should we make? And there are an infinite number of decisions that, again, cannot be decided. Well, they will ultimately, if there is a central decision maker in place, they will make a decision. But it may not be the decision you want. And it may, in fact, not be good for you. And I don't mean just in the sense of toothbrushes, but, of course, with every single aspect of everything we do in life. And again, I think it's the technocratic dream that we're going to hand all of this over to some, you know, some robot or something, some central thing that knows everything and can see everything that will somehow be able to determine what is best for each of us. Again, this runs into the problem, the fundamental economic calculation problem, which is a problem which comes about when you realize that the subjective theory of value, that things are valuable because we give them value, not because they are inherently valuable, but also because there are a million, a billion, a, well, 7+ billion different people on the planet who all have their own ideas and goals and aims and ends. And there is no one size fits all solution for everyone. And trying to fit people, shoehorn people into whatever centrally planned decision you make is not going to make for a happy population, to say the least. So, of course, the dream of all of the technocrats is we the technocratic class are going to manage this. And the lie that they'll use to get people to go along with that is, oh, look, it's the AI that we have created and programmed and tested and control and can tweak when we need to. It's the AI making these decisions honest. It's not the people programming the AI. It's not the people who are making these systems and controlling them and who ultimately can program in whatever they want into the system. No, it's the AI, and the AI knows all. And if the AI tells you you want a pink toothbrush, then you want a pink toothbrush, damn it. And you'll listen to us. So I think, again, this is nothing new. It's just a new shine on the old spit of the technocratic lie.
There actually was a Star Trek episode like that. The God, I forgot which God it was now. Anyway, yeah, it showed that very thing. You're almost describing the Gene Roddenberry episode. Well, you know, it shocks me, James, that no one is concerned that Google has killer robots, AI, quantum computers, and one of the largest DNA databases on the planet. Why is no one freaking out? Because their name's Google and they think it's silly, you know? But you saw they bought Boston Dynamics killer robots and, you know, the quantum computer and the AI and all of that. And no one says Skynet. No one's freaking out over that.
Right. And who's in charge of their black box division where they're coming up with all their secret special projects? It's Ray Kurzweil, the the singularity, we are going to merge with the machines guy. He is literally working at the top of Google now in their skunkworks.
I mean, no idea.
Yeah, it should be very concerning to every person on the planet. Because again, this is a wonderful, happy, friendly corporation with a nice white homepage.
Don't be evil, right?
Yeah, exactly. Don't be evil. It has these nice bright colors for their cute logo, and they don't charge you anything. You don't have to pay anything for anything Google does. So it must all be just benevolence, right? It must be all good. No, who? Obviously, the intelligence agencies that helped to get Google off the ground, and there's a lot of work that's been done by investigative researchers on that ground that I'll just point people in that direction. Start researching it if you haven't, because Google has been helped along by the intelligence agencies. And that's precisely because they were at least perceptive enough to realize that absolutely the 21st century, the most important thing in the 21st century will be data. Data on every single person, what they do, what they think, who they interact with, every single where you go. Every single piece of data that can be scooped up, Google is scooping up, and they are putting it into their big databases. And exactly right, they're merging it with their killer robots and all of their fancy technologies. And it's going to be the thing, whatever you say about the singularity and all of that idea, I think one thing that is true is that it is going to come very quickly when it comes. It's going to be an exponential process.
Right.
So that all of this stuff that's accruing under the Alphabet umbrella now, not Google, Alphabet, is going to arrive much more quickly than people realize. And you get the glimmers of it here and there. Something that I found very interesting is, you remember several years ago when YouTube first rolled out their auto transcriptions of videos, and it was like a game. You turn it on just to see how ridiculously garbled the computer gets all of this speech that it's listening to, right? And
right.
You read the text and it's just complete nonsense and
hilarious.
Has nothing to do with what the person is saying. Yeah, it was hilarious. You try it now, it's not so bad. It's definitely getting better. It's getting to the point where when I need to transcribe something, because I often do transcripts for my big documentary projects, when I need to transcribe something, I just turn that on and just copy paste it. And it's mostly accurate. It's 90%+ accurate at this point. How did they do that? How did that happen? While you weren't looking, they were doing things like Google Voice. People might remember this, that services like this that, again, they offer for free. Oh, you know, you can use Google Voice and it'll help you. It'll take messages and you can leave messages and you can direct it. And it was basically Siri before Siri. And they took all of that voice data, all of it, and they fed it through their self-iterative learning systems, their auto-generating AI, and they are getting very, very good at analyzing human speech. Now, this is a wonderful thing in some ways. I mean, it is good to have this technological capability, depending how it's used and for what and in what manner. And that's the thing, that's the double edge of every single one of these swords that they're wielding right now, that people don't even recognize as swords.
Yeah, we can't believe a single thing we see. We can clearly see that the technology exists to manufacture any event live on television without any problem. So let's get to look into the solution orientation, because you know, it seems like such a major problem. I mean, you know, we're all brainwashed into falling into line with government. We allow corruption. They had rape victims at the debates, you know. We've just gotten to this point in our society where no one believes in anything at all. And they also believe the most wild out there stuff instead. And the answers, I think, are so much more simple than trying to analyze, organize, and restructure this system. Trying to find our answers is not by digging so deep into all of this system, but to overgrow the government.
That's right. Literally digging, but digging in a garden.
It'd be amazing, right? Like this would end, this would stop Hunger Games right away, because we know that day's coming, right?
Mm-hmm.
I
hear you.
Yeah.
Freedom, yes. Freedom is the ability to live our lives without these systems of control that we've been conditioned to believe that we need. So anything that gets us towards that goal is for the good and is going to be necessary if we want to avoid the Hunger Games scenario. And one example of that is going to be simply getting out in your garden and getting your hands dirty. And that, it sounds so stupid. It sounds ridiculous to people who've been conditioned to believe that this is all some, you know, monumental struggle on a global civilizational scale. Well, it is, but it starts in your garden. And whether you're actually starting to try to find ways to become self-sustaining, it doesn't necessarily literally mean that all you can do is gardening. But those are the types of actions that we have to be rediscovering. Because so much of this is the fact that over the last few centuries, we have basically been cocooned in this entire worldview of we can't do anything for ourselves. We go to the supermarket and there's food there. Who cares how it came and who cares what it's doing? I've got some money, so I'll go and buy it. Or every other aspect of what we do in our day-to-day lives. And the idea that we need overarching systems of control rather than finding communities. And finding communities of interest to cooperate with has never been easier in the history of the world. As an example of that, I talked about a really simple but really powerful idea, I think, that is reflective of these types of ideas in a video that I did called P2P Solutions, an open source investigation, where I talked about a website called RipeNear.me. RipeNear.me is a very, very simple idea. It's a very simple concept. Basically, it's a world map. And on this map, you can post if you know of, if there's a, excuse me, a fruit tree in a publicly accessible area or whatever, you know, some flowering plant or something. If you know it, you put it on this, you know, Google map type thing, and, you know, Google being what it is. But at any rate, you put it on the map and people can find it and people can see when it's in season and people can go and actually, you know, get that food. Or if you have, you know, a fruit tree or you have a garden or you want to contribute to this, you put it on the map and people can participate in that and can come harvest at harvest time. An exceptionally simple idea, but it shows how powerful these types of ideas and technologies can be when we put them to our service rather right. than just, you know, oh, this is just the slave state and you're going to be told what to do. When we put it in the service of our ends and needs and goals and creating communities that we want so that we get to meet our neighbors and go, hey, you know, thanks for letting me do this. Hey, if you ever need your barn painted, I'll be happy to help out, or whatever that may be. Starting those connections truly is what will be the difference. Because if we don't have the communities that come together, that know each other and have worked with each other before, then the atomization of society is complete. And all that has to be done is the flick of the switch to cause the economic crisis or whatever kind of crisis. And you know, the rulers will be able to put in whatever system they want because we will be defenseless. Our defense comes in knowing what we want and cooperating with each other in order to get it, rather than asking for mommy government to come wipe our nose or daddy government to come spank the neighbor who's been bad. And until we grow up as a civilization and realize this is our struggle, it's not for some government to come along. It's not for some politician to come along and promise this or that. It's our struggle to create this. Once we realize that, the tools are there. We just have to start using them. And I think that's the most important thing to realize, is that so much of this already exists. It's just, it looks puny because so few people are participating in it, which is really the other side of this equation, which is we need the revolution of the mind. We need people to understand why it is important to be doing things like participating in a farmer's market or whatever, you know, those types of local things. Because if people don't understand the importance of it, then how will we ever grow it? And if we don't grow it, then we are at the mercy of those who can throw us into chaos at any time.
Absolutely. Well said. And folks, anybody can create their own social network. I did with the Friendship Agenda, friendshipagenda.com, a great place to go meet like minds and get to know people. And that is a free software, open source, that you can manipulate and set up as you want. And you can have your own Facebook, your own MySpace. Mine happens to be friendshipagenda.com, so that you can go and join other people. You can use this to go anywhere in the world right now. I use it all the time to travel. And it's so simple for any of us now to make these leaps and bounds and connections. It's astounding. And you are absolutely right. From the idea of us ever being podcasters and being able to talk to tens of thousands of people every week, to the point that we can build our own social network sites, we can have our own communities, forums, anything you need, down to the point of putting food on the map so that people can see where this all goes. The next big leap, of course, is going to be the racial strife. There's no doubts whatsoever that they are formulating a race war in America, and it's, you know, it's up to us to stand in between this and you know, network this friendship agenda, rather, no matter what race, creed, or anything, because it's more than that.
Well,
it's
bigger. Yes, and think of it this way: whatever the social engineers want to engineer in, we have to be going the opposite way. And everything that every button that is being pushed right now in America and other places around the world is the divide button. It's divide people along race, divide people along gender, and divide people along political lines, and divide, 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 divide. That is their agenda. So our agenda has to be the opposite. So friendship agenda is a pretty good way of putting it, I'd say.
Absolutely. Friendship is the new currency. I've proven it. It works. And you can go all over the world, folks, and if you have friendship in your heart and a dear desire to ask the simple question, what can I do to help? And you can go anywhere in the world. I've proven this. Well, we're getting round to this end of the hour here, and James, he needs to get back to his 10 years of service and get into more of his own Corbett report. Sorry, my train of thought left because Diva came in here and was all like getting up to me. But folks, I'm gonna jump over in the members section and just get personal with you. Talk about life, general life, the universe, and everything. It will be in the members section for all of you, so that we can get to know one another more. And I have a lot of new subscribers, and I want to just kind of get in there and have a personal moment with all of you. So, James. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been a very enlightening show. I've learned a lot in this very, very fast hour. And I definitely, folks, everybody needs to get over to CorbettReport.com. 10 years running. How are you going to celebrate your anniversary?
I'm not sure I've completely decided yet. It'll be a low-key affair. But yeah, I am going to celebrate some way, because who would have thought a decade ago, me sitting there in my little one-room studio apartment here in Japan was going to create this thing, which is now on the daily list of tens of thousands of people to come listen to what I have to say. I mean, it's an incredible thing. Again, truly unthinkable. So I think, I'm not blowing my own horn here so much as pointing out what is possible now. Things that were literally unimaginable a decade or two ago are now possible and in our grasp, and I mean everyone's grasp. So I think that's something worth pointing out, because we get enough of the news about how small and powerless and weak and puny we all are on a daily basis from the Mockingbird media. So it's time to try to counteract that and show how powerful we really are as individuals.
I so often think, unfortunately, of the Matrix and just that concept of Neo being that meek fellow when he had the power of the universe inside of him the whole time. And I really feel that's what we are. We're these gods on this planet. We're sovereign beings that can live up to amazing heights of nobility and stature. And we're all cowering away because of the whip of the master.
Speaking of the Matrix, I should just say that there is going to be a Red Pill Expo taking place in Bozeman, Montana on June 23rd, 24th. And I will be appearing at giving a presentation there on a Red Pill Matrix kind of theme, but via Skype. I'm not going to be there in person, but people who are interested should check that out, redpillexpo.org. There's going to be a lot of speakers there like G. Edward Griffin and Patrick Wood and others. So it'll definitely be worth checking out.
Fantastic. I got to figure out why I'm never invited to these things.
I don't know why I was, but I'm glad. It was amazing because G. Edward Griffin got in touch and said, would you like to speak at this? And G. Edward Griffin, of course, author of Creature from Jekyll Island about the Federal Reserve. He was a major source for my Federal Reserve documentary. So there was that angle to it. And then there's the red pill sort of organizing theme of the expo. And I had sitting here this essay that I'd written for this book that I've been promising for almost a decade about the Federal Reserve monetary system and the Matrix / Red Pill. I had this already waiting, so it was amazing coincidence or synchronicity, perhaps. So I took advantage of that and said, "Hey, I'll appear."
So, anything else coming in your near future?
I will also be at the Open Mind Conference in Denmark this September. I haven't been doing a lot of international travel recently because of my very small children. I have a 4-year-old boy and a 1-year-old daughter. So I'm not going to saddle my wife with that for too long. But I will be going to Denmark in September for the Open Mind Conference to give a speech there on echoes of World War I in the China-U.S. relationship. So that's at openmindconference.com.
That is coming, isn't it? The Russia-China alliance.
It's being engineered as we speak. And yeah, I don't like where this is going because generally this means war. And of course, the elite at the very top aren't really warring. They're conspiring. But the wars still really take place, just like World War I and World War II really took place, even if the people at the top were all connected.
Yeah, that sticks with me. Sorry, we still got a few more minutes. So that really sticks with me when my mother was in World War II, my father as well, but my mother more so in that she grew up in France and would walk these war-torn, blown-up streets, seeing an arm. Like, this is my mother telling me a story of her life. Yeah, we'd walk down the street and there'd be an arm, and you'd think there'd be somebody buried under there, and I'd go and try to undig them and find out it's just this arm. And growing up with that type of detail about warfare and knowing, because we're so kowtowed here in America, we don't know war. We know we've never had this major devastation like that. We have no idea what we're in for, and we don't realize that it just happens. And my mother really helped me with that.
Yeah, no, it's you're right. We've lived a very sheltered existence in the Western developed countries for the last generation or two, and we don't know what massive bloodshed looks like. And that is one of the worrying parts about it, because people almost think, oh, it'll be a good thing if there's a big war. It'll, you know, man us up and make us great again and all of that stuff. And people don't really know what they're getting into, unfortunately, because unfortunately, as always, the psychopathic ruling would-be oligarchs are happy to use us as pawns and to see rivers of blood. As long as it's not their blood, it's our blood being spilled on the streets. They're happy to have that happen. And again, it's all connected at the top. It's always the Kissinger and the Chinese ruling oligarchs, and all these people are always conspiring at the top, but they're happy to keep the war footing on the 2D chessboard than get the pawns basically to sacrifice their lives for this game.
So we're really at that point now where, and this will be the end, we're at that point now where we have to step up. It's do or die, literally, at this point.
It really is. And I know every generation says this and thinks this, and maybe it is true every generation. But at any rate, it is absolutely true for us, because there is, as we've been talking about, this technological overlay to it. And there are now technological things possible that never would have been even imaginable before in human history, to the point where the idea of humanity itself is now at stake, and what it means to be human, and whether we will continue as the human race or whether we will be engineered into something pliable and disposable by an elite that merges with the machines and becomes gods, or whatever they are planning, whatever their psychotic vision is, it generally doesn't include our best interest. And yeah, we are at the point where we're talking in the decades scale now rather than centuries, and things are going to start moving faster and faster. So the more prepared we are mentally and otherwise, the better we'll be able to divert it. I think that's the real message for today. We have to divert this agenda because, again, the humanity is always moving, but we have to keep it moving in our direction and not be stunted off into some other onto some other track.
So realize, folks, that intercommunication, global communication, chatting with your friends, this is a positive thing. Growing your garden, just having a good time and feeling relaxed and enjoying it. Okay, realize that war is coming because it is not under your power. It is not under your ideas. It is manipulated and caused by these oligarchs. So you can't do anything about that. But if you're communicating with your friends, making new friends, if you're growing food and feeling comfortable and getting yourself in a nice state of mind, this state of mind will permeate those that surround you. We can lift each other up so easily with our own happiness that we will not even realize that we changed the world in this simple way. Any final words there, James?
That was beautiful. Let's make it happen. Friendship, community is what it's about. Let's concentrate on that and not so much about bickering and war and argumentation.
There you go. Thank you so much, James, for giving us your time. I'm so glad you're out there doing your independent journalism. Everybody get over to thecorbettreport.com if you want to keep up to date on all the machinations that are going on around us and, have a much, much more simpler understanding and a better ideas to move ahead. So thank you all so much for tuning in and subscribing to freemantv.com. I hope you're checking out the coffee at PV. That's a V like in victory, pvroasters.com. They're, just a great family that I want to support. And again, get yourself 4 pounds of coffee because you're going to want it. And the shipping's the same as a single pound. So remember to put free man in the promo code so some of that money comes back to the show. And thank you all for being you and all the great letters that you're writing to the guests and writing and telling everybody that this is a great show. That's awesome. I hear it over and over again, especially from my guests, how amazing you guys are. So I never want you to forget that. And we're all going to meet in the future, I guarantee it. Thank you all, and good night.